Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
When you think the piece is so eccentric or so idiosyncratic or so neurotic or so weird and so personally your own little peccadilloes and anxieties, just when I think, boy, I'm going to send this in and my editor's going to think this woman is really nuts, that's when it's ready to send. And not before that.
This week, we are delighted to welcome humorist, writer, playwright, actress, moth storyteller. Hey, Jenny, that makes you a quintuple threat.
Oh, my God.
We haven't had that many quintuple threats. And excellent home cook, Jenny Allen. Her new book is the laugh out loud funny Would Everybody Please Stop? Reflections on Life and Other Bad Ideas. Welcome to Special Sauce, the woman that Andy Borowitz calls one of the funniest writers in America, Jenny Allen.
Hello, Ed. I am thrilled to be here.
Oh, it's
thrilled
a pleasure to have you. I have so many things I want to talk to you about. My first question is usually tell us about life at the family table, but I have to say you have actually described in excruciating detail in your book what life at the family table was like.
Yeah.
And I feel like I should, rather than me read it, I feel like you should read just the first two paragraphs of this.
Yes, okay. Read it and weep, or
yes.
Try not to weep.
Or maybe the first, go all the way down to the end of the first section.
All right, you'll tell me when to
all
stop.
Right.
All right. I'm afraid there's no way to say this without sounding pitiful, so I'm just going to say it. I used to eat cookies out of open packages on supermarket shelves. I was a child, but still it was an odd thing to do. I'd go to the supermarket with my mother and ditch her as fast as I could to hang out in the cookie aisle. In my adult life, I've rarely seen an open package of cookies in a supermarket, so I can't explain why I seemed to see them all the time as a child, but I did. And when I found an open box or torn cellophane wrapping, I would stand in the aisle and furtively shove the cookies into my mouth. Pop, pop, pop. The thrill of finding the packages was like one of those dreams when you find $20 bills blowing all over the sidewalk. Only better, at least to a child, because it was Malomars and Oreos and ginger snaps and Nilla wafers. Pecan sandies, Vienna fingers, whatever they called the spicy ones shaped like windmills, studded with slivers of almond. Oh, the joy of it. I told a friend about this the other day. I thought she was going to tell me she'd done it too. I'd always assumed this was one of those childhood pastimes that most children engaged in but didn't bother to mention as adults, like biting their toenails or picking their scabs. She looked like she was going to cry. That is so sad, she said. I had to wonder, why had I spent my childhood trolling for food in the cookie aisle at Gerstides? Ah, that's right. My mother didn't feed me. Well, that's not entirely true. She fed us, my brother, sister, and me. My parents were divorced. But that's about all you could say. My mother was overwhelmed. My mother had been handed some real lemons in life. My mother was doing the best she could, but boy... We had food, three or four different entrees, fried hamburgers and lima beans, corned beef hash with an egg on top, fried lamb chops, liver and bacon. That was it. That was the repertoire.
And that's awesome. That's so great because it's so evocative of a time, and also it's very, very personal. And it doesn't sound like life at the Allen family table was that much fun.
No, not much fun. No, no, no. You know, I was trying to think, knowing I was going to, you know, see you today. What did we talk about at the table? Because I've heard you ask other guests that same question. And I honestly can't remember at my mother's table. It was so strained. I think she was so dealing with so much in her life that I think we just kind of got through dinner.
Right.
And
you survived each and every dinner.
We survived each and every dinner. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. And you and I've eaten with you and eaten your food, and you're such a good cook, and you have so much joy when you eat, but you talk, in the book you talk about the tension around eating and food and the joylessness with which it was served,
yes.
Which was so resonant for me because I take so much joy and pleasure in eating.
I know. It's like the rest of it. It's like a second chance, isn't it? I just feel like we get this ever since, you know, leaving my that household, food has been this intense pleasure for me every single day. There is a do-over quality to it. I mean, it's just thrilling. I'd probably take way too much pleasure in it, but
I
do.
Is it a do-over quality or a leftover quality? Sorry, I couldn't resist. It was right there.
Leftovers. I love those, too. Love them.
You talk in the book about getting to college and
oh,
nobody has ever written this, that college food was like a dream.
A dream.
Tell us why college food for you was like a dream.
It was a dream. I guess, first of all, it was served without resentment. And my mother had many wonderful qualities. And she was doing her best with three children. But still... the fact that it was served so in college so freely and without a sense of I had to do this again for you people, and even cheerfully, and that there was there were copious amounts of it. There was choice. If you didn't like the liver and onions, that was okay because there was shepherd's pie. A choice. I'd never heard of that. And I had eaten in restaurants, but there it was. And those steam tables, I mean, I just thought it was like a miracle. And then you could have seconds and nobody complained.
Where were you in college?
I went to Smith for a year and then I transferred to Yale.
Right.
And now I went back for my reunion for the first time in 30 years. And I noticed that my palate has developed a little over time. The food has really is by regular standards, not just my kind of the low bar I had set back when I was 17. It was really quite delicious.
Oh,
lots of farm-to-table stuff.
Especially at Yale, where Alice Waters was put in charge of revamping the food.
No, because, I didn't even know
because
that.
Because her daughter, Fanny, went there. And
oh,
so
my goodness.
It became a thing. And
I had no idea. Hence, at the reunion, this is local butter. This is, they told you which farm the butter was from. And it was fantastic. The food was fantastic.
And even though it was local and probably cost more and was less institutional, there were still seconds.
Seconds! Oh, my God, I couldn't believe that. I did gain, I really, I wrote in the original copy that I handed in to my editor, Sarah Crichton, I had written that I gained 20 pounds in 2 weeks, and she circled that and wrote something a little more realistic, like, 2 months or something. But it really probably, I think it was 20 pounds in 2 weeks. I mean, I just could not stop shoveling it in. Yeah, I was in
heaven.
So
you were starved both physically and emotionally sort of much of your life until you got to college.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, I have to say that, and I do point this out in the piece, that my parents were divorced and we would spend time with my dad as well. And he, thank God, loved food. And he was single for a couple of years. And he cooked, and he was a home cook. Not fancy, but he loved eating.
And he took pleasure in it.
And he took great pleasure in it. And he was a big guy. He's always trying to lose weight. But he loved eating. And then he married my stepmother, who was a really lovely person. What year would this have been? Say, maybe, let's say mid-60s.
Right.
And she was a young bride, much younger than he. She took James Beard's cooking course. And man, she was a fantastic cook. And she was, you know, it was the 60s, but as we were talking the other night when we were together, you know, the 60s were kind of the 50s for a lot of people too until
65 or whatever.
Yeah. So she was very much a kind of conventional young wife, and she made fabulous dinners. It meant a lot to her, and she knew how much he loved to eat. We ate incredible food. really almost every night.
Yeah.
She made a proper dinner for him, and she wrote it all down in a notebook. She
wow.
Had it. Mm-hmm.
That's intense.
But I and
there were seconds.
And always seconds. And once I was thinking on my way over here, Ed, thinking about her and how, again, freely and with great pleasure, she served food and we all ate it. Once she, one of her, something that she made very well was just a basic chocolate mousse. And one day she said, I made you something. I thought you'd like it. And it was an entire mixing bowl full of chocolate mousse.
Wow.
I mean, she just, it was a huge bowl and I just took it up to my room and just read and ate it all afternoon. I'm sure I felt sick afterwards, but it was...
One of the greatest gifts of all time.
Oh, my God, the best present ever.
Much better than, like, a string of pearls.
Oh, God, 100 times. 100 times
so,
better.
So when did you get interested in writing, in storytelling?
Well, let's see. That was my dad's... My dad was an editor, so... We were always around words. He was a magazine editor.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I was in high school when I got enough praise from teachers about my writing that I knew that this was a skill that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was perhaps the only skill that I had, that I was aware of having. And it was the only thing that I knew I was really good at that. And I went, even without thinking too much, into magazine writing.
Yeah.
It was kind of what my dad did. Well, he was an editor, but he had been an English teacher. So it seemed to be kind of the family profession to be in magazines.
Got it.
I never really particularly wanted to be an editor. I wanted to be a magazine writer.
You wanted to be a magazine. And so you started writing features, right? And,
yeah.
And a lot of profiles.
I did a ton of profiles for 30 years. I mean, I did lots of profiles of actors and writers. I did a long piece about Arthur Miller. I did a piece about Lanford Wilson, about David Mamet. That's all playwrights, interestingly enough, because I was always interested in theater, too, and had done some acting. And lots of actors are hard. You know, Mickey Rourke, I remember. And actors are kind of tricky to interview because I didn't know this. Christopher Walken I interviewed. And I thought it was a really good piece. This was for the Daily News when I went to work for Clay Felker, who started the afternoon, short-lived afternoon kind of magazine-y version, came out in the afternoon edition of the Daily News. And I had a long interview with Christopher Walken, and I thought it was really great because he had talked to me, and I know he was not a man given to interviews, but he had talked to me at length about how he prepared for a part, the kind of method he chose, how he thought about acting, and I took it to a colleague of mine at the News, a writer named Jan Hodenfeld. I don't know if do you remember Jan Hodenfeld,
yeah.
Really good writer.
Yeah.
And I used to show him my copy because I always overwrote, and he was very elegant and efficient as a writer and a kind guy. And he just took, it sounds cruel, but he wasn't cruel. He just took a red pencil and he just X'd out all the stuff about acting. He said, you can never ask actors really about acting because they get so... You can't understand it. It's boring. Please, Jenny, this all has to go. So, and I did a lot. I think I interviewed Katie Couric 3 times for Good Housekeeping. We got it down to a science. That was very fun. And, I even interviewed George Bush once for Good Housekeeping for a Mother's Day issue in the Oval Office, which was I would have to say, I sometimes criticize people, and including in my book, for using the word surreal too much, but it was a surreal experience. He got quite angry with me. Have I told you this story?
No.
Oh, it was, oh. Is it okay to tell
the
story?
Yeah.
I wish it had something to do with food.
Darn it. We talk about food and life.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Yes, I knew that. Before our allotted 20-minute interview in the Oval Office, we gathered in one of the sitting rooms, the yellow room,
at the White House.
At the White House, yes. So that he could have his picture taken by a very famous fancy photographer, a male whose name I forget. He and Laura. This was a Mother's Day issue of Good Housekeeping. And the questions I was to ask him all had to do with, per previous agreement between the magazine and his PR guy, press spokesperson, would have to do with Laura and his mother, like strong women was the theme. Anyway, so we all gathered there because they wanted to get the picture done first. And many people were in the room, the photographer and all his assistants and much equipment and a lot of staffers. And on my way up with this young male staffer, I had said, we've all agreed that it's okay for me to take notes during the picture taking for a little color because I only had this 20 minutes with the guy. And he said, of course, that goes without saying. Very natch. So I was sitting and perched in the corner there, and he came in finally and was chatting with the photographer. And we all had to put on white surgical booties because they had just cleaned the carpets. Anybody who entered, he didn't have to, of course, and Laura didn't have to, but the staff didn't have to, I noticed. But the rest of us, like we were bringing in germs from the outside, had to wear these hilarious booties. So anyway, finally, they start the picture. I'm just taking notes on, there's not much color going on because he's saying, right. How y'all doing and stuff like that. But I'm taking little notes. He's chatting with Laura a little bit. And then he stops in the middle of this session and he says, "Who's the lady taking notes in the corner?" And I'm looking around for my little helper young guy there, the spokesman.
Who's disappeared.
Who's there in the sea of people somewhere. But I can't see him. I'm looking, where is this guy who said, "Yes, of course you can take notes." And I said, "Well, I'm taking, I'm from the magazine." And he says, "Don't y'all know there's no taking notes in here?" And I can't, where the hell is my helper? Nowhere to be found, or somewhere with his head bowed in the sea of faces. And he really yelled at me. And he said, "Y'all have to stop taking notes now." And I just kept thinking, I should say, "Mr. President, I've been told I can take notes." But of course, not of course. I did chicken out. I closed my notebook. And then when the session was over, he and I took together, there's the two of us, this tiny little elevator down. And he said, he clapped me on the back really so hard it hurt. And he said something, "No hard feelings. Hope y'all didn't mind me." He said, "You just never know who's taking notes." And I did say then, having recouped a tiny bit of courage, "Mr. President, this is Good Housekeeping. We are really, really not out to do anything but the most positive piece we can." "Well, that's good to hear." And, then we went into the Oval Office, and on the way in, he gave me this clap on my back, another clap on my back to sort of push me into the room. And it was so hard that I would have to say he struck me. I mean, it was the hardest. I'm sure I had a hand imprint on me for days.
It was a back punch. It wasn't a back slap.
It was a punch. It was really uncomfortable. And that's my George Bush story.
That's funny. Ugh. So you were writing features, but you weren't writing your humor pieces. And I read it in an interview you did in the Times recently. Yeah. You said, "I think for a long time I had a failure of courage to write in my own voice. Even though I liked doing it, I'd feel delighted and then weird and guilty about it."
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, very neurotic.
Do you think that's,
I still am.
Do you think that's true of every creative person? There's a certain leap that you have to take. I know, like, when I was writing music reviews and features about pop music and jazz, like, I never found my own voice. I was always just aping the people that I admired.
Absolutely.
But then when I started writing about food, people said, oh, this is so cool, because it's like listening to you talk about food.
Oh, it's, yes. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, God bless the people who find that voice earlier. It did take me a really long time. I was discontent, but I knew how to write in a kind of journalist's omniscient voice, slightly distanced. I had spent years writing in a kind of corporate voice at Time Inc. I worked for Life magazine and writing those text blocks and longer pieces as well. But that sort of journalist's, again, omniscient voice, that I was kind of hid behind, but I felt that there was something out there, something much kookier in there waiting to get out. But I just didn't have the confidence to do it.
Is there one piece of advice in terms of figuring out how to get to that point where you can just take the leap? You know, like, what would it be?
Maybe it's seize the day. That is to say, I think I spent a lot of years thinking, I'll try that later after I've really... I'll try that later because I'm not really legitimate enough to do it now.
It's sort of pretend you're...
Just, yes.
Aspire to legitimacy before you feel comfortable doing
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That nobody's going to hand it to you.
Yeah.
And I think I really had to stay way too long at the fair before I took that leap. I did start doing more idiosyncratic pieces before I did get cancer. But getting cancer kind of, there's nothing like having cancer to say, well, there's nothing left to lose here. I mean, it's no time like the present.
So it really was your Kris Kristofferson, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
I'm afraid so. And also, I did feel compelled to, well, I wouldn't call it much of a living, but to bring in dough, you know, to make some money. I really didn't feel that I was so uncertain that I didn't feel brave enough to kind of write without knowing that I had some editor on the other end who would edit it and then pay me a little dough.
Are you okay? I mean, I saw the one woman play you did, which was I Got Sick and Then I Got Better.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You're good, right?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah. Yeah.
But that play, when I saw it, we didn't know each other very well.
Right.
It was so moving and funny and
I'm glad you
resonant.
Liked it. Yeah, you don't have to go on. Thanks for saying that.
You know, I my mother died of cancer, but I don't think that was the reason I related
good,
to it.
Good.
I think it was more like it was just so human.
Well, you know, thank you for saying that, Ed. I'm very grateful. I still do the show. I do it. I do it at its full length, which is 80 or so minutes. I do it an hour version. The other day I did it at a cancer. I do it, you know, for a lot of cancer or some you know cancer conventions and conferences and stuff, and fundraisers, and there's a wonderful group in New York called Tina's Wish, which is I'm not a part of, but they hired me to do it, and I did. They said, "Can you do about 25 minutes from the show?" And I did 25 minutes, and I wondered afterwards, "Gee, I bet I could do the." I wonder how short the show could get before, like, I bet, you know, 7 minutes, I could probably.
See, now you're thinking the digital way.
I'm totally thinking the digital way. You could probably get the whole thing in a 3-minute YouTube. I could do it. I could do it for your group. But I had a big life-changing moment. James Lapine, whom I had met, but I didn't really know.
The famous director.
Yes, Steve.
March of the Falsettos.
Yes, which they just revived last year, as you know. And writer, did the book for so much of Sondheim's work.
Right.
And has directed it. Anyway, he happened to see me do an early very early reading of what became the show and at the Martha's Vineyard Playhouse. And he said, I'd like to direct, I'd like to work with you on this, which was, I couldn't believe it. And anyway, to make a long story short, his feeling about it was, he said, this can't be a cancer show. It's got to be anybody who's had life-threatening travails or knows somebody who has, which is everybody, should be able to see this show and relate to it. It's not a medical show. It's not a, although there's a lot in it about some, a couple of my early doctors who were not that helpful, but, or didn't, you know, diagnose it. But it's not a polemic. It's an entertainment.
You always
called it an entertainment. It has to be a piece of theater and an entertainment.
It really is.
Well, I'm glad that you saw it that way.
I think I'm going to revive it. I'm going to
produce
the revival.
So
you started writing humor pieces.
Yes.
And for you, what's the key to writing funny? Is there one piece of advice you would give to aspiring humor writers?
Well, that's another thing I think about a lot. Something I say sometimes, which is, I think, even true for me, is when you think the piece is so eccentric or so idiosyncratic or so neurotic or so weird and so personally your own little peccadilloes and anxieties, just when I think, boy, I'm going to send this in and my editor's going to think this woman is really nuts, that's when it's ready to send. And not before that.
When they're going to have to think about maybe Jenny needs some time, a time out.
A little time out. That's when it's ready to send. When you think, I shouldn't put this in, this is too weird, or this little worry or obsession of mine is too strange, that's when it's time to send it in. And that's what is responded to. You'd think you wouldn't have to learn that lesson every time,
right,
but I seem to.
But that's interesting because, you know, like my friend Brian Koppelman has a podcast called The Moment. And that is the moment, I think, in every creative person's life, like I'm writing this book now.
Yes.
And as you said that, I'm like, oh, maybe that's the moment I should look for. And you're scared of it, and you're really excited by it at the same time.
Absolutely. You're describing it exactly. Scared of it, but excited about it. And otherwise, it's merely clever.
Yeah.
And clever's okay, but it doesn't make you, for a humor piece, you know, the stakes are kind of ridiculous because clever's fine. What I hope that I did with magazine work.
Right.
But if there's something, got to be something kind of bent about it to be for a humor piece. And the demands of a humor piece are, the stakes are pretty high. That is, it better be funny. It better make people laugh.
Yes.
And so it's kind of distilled into that. And that's kind of a little bit of a high wire act.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. And Richard Pryor always used to talk about that great comedy is rooted in the truth.
Yes, it always has to be truthful.
And that when you stray from the truth, you're getting away from your own comedic voice.
But to even know what's true, because sometimes we fool ourselves about what's true. The Moth, which I love being associated with, and I've been to it all the time, and so, and I've hosted a couple of times, and I listen to it all the time on the radio, and what you've told yourself is the truth may not be, it has to be your truth, and it has to be truthful.
Right.
I mean, I have a friend who wanted to do something for the Moth, and he had been in jail for white collar crime, and I said, you know, it seems like to me, you gotta mind that, right? He kind of sent me a full of anecdote story about being in jail, but the summation really of his story was that, guess what? Jail, being in prison, is actually funny. And when I read through it and talked to him, I had to say, you know, there's a lot of humor in it, but it really wasn't that funny that you went to jail.
He wanted it to be funny. He wanted the conclusion to be funny. And then he wanted that to be the truth. But that's because he was scared away from the real truth.
Yeah. And the humor, he still could have had humor in it.
Right.
But he had to start from the place of terror and humiliation and shame and guilt and let the humor come from that. Anyway, finding that truth is also a big challenge.
Yeah.
Before you even set pen to paper.
So, Jenny, we've been sitting in the studio gabbing like we're in your kitchen. And we haven't even talked about your great new book, Would Everybody Please Stop?
Oh, my goodness. Well,
Reflections on Life and Other Bad Ideas. Would you come back?
Come back? Are you kidding? I never want to leave.
All right.
I'll just bring lunch in now, and then we can keep talking later.
Fantastic. Thanks for stopping by, Jenny, and we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.